back your country, and you have to tell the world that the U.S. people does not support them, that the U.S. people does not support war.
Tommy Franks will become MacArthur, and Iraq will become Japan.
The things that we're protesting right now outside of Fort Benning are directly related to war on Iraq.
The demonizing and manipulation of their minds by Fort Benning. I mean, after all, Fort Benning is a place where you're taught to be soldiers. That means you're taught to kill.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, November 18th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. United Nations weapons inspectors have arrived in Baghdad, poised to launch a new round of inspections aimed at disarming Iraqi President Saddam Hussein of any weapons of mass destruction he may be harboring. The 27-member UN team is set to begin its work on Thanksgiving Eve. The mission could determine whether the Mideast is plunged into a new war. Tariq Aziz, Iraq's deputy prime minister, gave his clearest warning yet yesterday that Baghdad would launch strikes against Israel if it was attacked by Britain and America. Norm Finkelstein, author of Image and Reality of the Israeli-Palestine Conflict, has written extensively about Zionism and the Middle East. During a visit today to our Pacifica studio, he downplayed Baghdad's threat to bomb Israel if attacked by the U.S. or Britain.
Well, there have been credible reports, that if Saddam is pushed into the corner, that he will let loose with everything because he'll have nothing to lose. So there's reasonable prospects that if he feels this is a do-or-die time, that the war can take a very, very ugly turn.
Well, now, Secretary of State Colin Powell has cautioned the Bush administration against attacking Iraq, saying that it would, in fact, destabilize the region.
I think a lot of this is just a good cop, bad cop routine. It's hard to believe that even Colin Powell believes that he has any real sway over what U.S. policy is in the region. They're pretty clear about what they want to do, though there seems to be a recognition around the edges that this may, I happen to think it won't, but this may go awry. And if it goes awry, the consequences can be pretty, let's just say the consequences are unpredictable.
Let's talk about that. If this goes awry, meaning if the U.S. attacks Iraq and the ramifications that it would have throughout the Middle East.
Well, first of all, I think a lot of this talk about the Arab street is a chimera. I don't think it really exists. There was already twice where there was all of this speculation about the Arab street. On the eve of the first devastation of Iraq in 1991, there was actually quite a lot of concern among mainstream establishment types about going into Iraq and the kinds of repercussions it would have on the quote-unquote Arab street. And that's why many establishment figures like Robert McNamara opposed the first attack on Iraq. As it happened, there was no reaction in the Arab street. It proved to be a chimera. And then there was, on the eve of the attack on Afghanistan, there was again all of this talk about the Arab street. Nothing materialized. I think the Bush administration has inferred from the past two experiences, looking at the historical track record, that they probably can get away with it a third time.
Mm-hmm. You don't think that this war will destabilize the region
at all?
No,
not really, because I think people who say that don't really understand politics very well. You can't destabilize these regimes unless you really have organization, ideology, people willing to go out there and organize, you know, masses of people. It doesn't exist in the Arab world. I mean, it's regrettably the case, but it happens to be true. And so what you will have is you could have periods of unrest and chaos, anarchical rebellion. But in terms of a sustained threat, I think people are very naive if they think that you can pose a sustained threat to these regimes in the absence of organization some sort of program to seize the imagination of people.
Now, what kind of ramifications do you foresee might occur as a result in terms of terrorism and attacks?
The reasonable expectation is, you see, with this particular horror that's impending, it's very hard to, as a person of the left or a person who cares about human life, forget about the left, it's very hard to judge whether you want a fast war or a slow war. If it's a fast war, of course, it's a horror, because the hunger of these people grows with each country they devour. So there's that sort of danger. It's the Nazi danger. With each success, the hunger grows. On the other hand, if the war starts going awry, it doesn't go according to plan.
And what would be awry?
Awry means that, in fact, the resistance turns out to be greater than one can reasonably expect.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. anticipated. More soldiers are getting killed than was expected, getting bogged down in the cities and unable to extricate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with these folks in Washington, there is just no telling what they're going to do. And that goes, I don't want to say a fortiori, I would say it goes just as strongly for the state of Israel. If things start getting out of hand, and there are germ war attacks in Israel, mm-hmm. chemical war attacks, biological attacks, Israel's a very tiny place. You know, it's a pinprick on the world's map. Those people are pretty crazy also. And they often talk about what they call the Samson option.
What is that?
Bringing down the temple with them. And if they reach the point where they really feel threatened, they'll let loose with their nuclear weapons. I mean, those are real dangers.
So we're talking World War III here.
I don't say we're talking because I don't think it's going to. I think it's going to be pretty fast. I happen not to think there's going to be tremendous resistance, and I don't think there's going to be a reaction from the Arab street. I say if it goes awry, which you can't predict, then things get very, very scary. Again, things can go awry, but I happen not to believe so. What is possible is that there will be, and this you certainly can't predict, there will be significant terrorist reactions in the United States and elsewhere. And then it could get pretty ugly here.
Yeah, that would be going awry in my book. That'd be very awry.
Well, it'll be awry for several reasons. You know, recent polls have showed, let's see, Americans now support the torture of potential terrorists. 1 in 4 support the use of nuclear weapons and so forth, meaning that the levels of tolerance are rapidly going through the ground. And I suspect if there's an attack on if and when there's the attack on Iraq, and if and when there's the terrorist response, you know, a few subways being blown up, a few bridges being blown up, anyone who's dissenting is going to be rounded up.
Okay. So Norman Finkelstein is predicting here on Pacifica that if there is an attack on Iraq, it's not going to go awry.
You're going to be broadcasting from jail. No, I'm already making provisions for somebody to pay my rent. So if I'm in jail for a year, I won't come back and learn that I was evicted. I think that that's pretty a reasonable speculation, that there will be terrorist reactions here, and anybody who then attempts to protest the war will be rounded up. I think that's a likely scenario. And it's one, you know, we can laugh about, but it's one that we should also plan for and take into account. That will all depend on public opinion. Surely nobody has any naive thoughts that Ashcroft wouldn't want to do it. It depends on public opinion. And judging from the public opinion polls now, it's quite likely that public opinion would acquiesce in that kind of roundup. I don't mean, you know, World War II type concentration camps, but
It sounds like that's what you're...
Look, again, it depends. There are a lot of variables. It's a war.
Norm Finkelstein is the author of four books, including Image and Reality of the Israel-Palestine Conflict and The Rise and Fall of Palestine. As war looms on the horizon, women across the U.S. who oppose sending their sons and daughters off to fight the sons and daughters of Iraqi women held a peace vigil outside the White House to promote peaceful alternatives to conflict. Chris Strom of the Indy Media Center in Washington, D.C. attended the vigil.
What do you say? No war, no way!
On Sunday, November 17th, Women United for Peace began a peace vigil and fast in front of the White House to oppose the U.S. government's rush to war with Iraq. The new coalition has issued an emergency code pink alert, which calls on women in the United States and in other countries to raise their voices for peace and take action to promote peaceful alternatives to war. Women in the coalition say they cannot be quiet as the administration of President Bush rushes into war with Iraq that is unjust, will kill thousands of innocent people, and will take valuable resources away from much-needed social programs in the United States that help women and families. Anise Jenkins is with Black Voices for Peace.
It's very important that women are here to speak out. We are the mothers, the wives, and the sisters of those who will be killed for oil, blood for oil.
The coalition also hopes to galvanize a new women's movement against war, as it already consists of diverse groups such as the National Organization for Women and Global Exchange, an international human rights organization. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of Global Exchange and Women United for Peace. Why is it important for women to be out here protesting the coming war with Iraq?
I think many people around the country have been saying, where are the women's voices? And women's groups have been starting to form spontaneously around the country to say no to war. We need to bring that together into a major presence, both here in front of the White House as well as around the country.
Terry O'Neill is a vice president with the National Organization for Women.
This war is essentially a war of aggression against Iraq. It is unjust. It is unjustified. It is a violation of international law norms. That's the spiritual and moral impoverishment of this war. But the material impoverishment is something that has been disturbing me lately a great deal. For over a year, the Bush administration has used the excuse of the war against terrorism to divert billions, tens of billions of dollars from desperately underfunded poverty and social programs to Mr. Bush's military buildup.
The vigil will be held 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in front of the White House and include ongoing hunger strikes from women who say they are coming out of their comfort zones in order to stop war.
There is a certain level of moving beyond our comfort zone that I personally feel is necessary right now. That includes, for me, not eating. It includes sleeping out in the rain, in the park, in the cold. And I think it just deepens the level of commitment to say that when our nation and our planet are in danger, that we have to step outside that comfort zone, whatever that is for us. And this is our way of expressing that right now.
Diane Wilson, a mother of five from Cedric, Texas, started her fast on November 18th and plans to go 40 days.
I feel compelled for my community, and I feel compelled for this country and this whole planet that we have to stop this madness. And that's why I'm here. That's my intent, and 40 days is my level of commitment.
Women must stand up and say, for the sake of future generations, for the sake of our children, for the sake of our communities and the future of our planet, we cannot allow George Bush to drag us into a state of perpetual war. Let's draw the line in the sand. Let's be the one to stop him here.
There's been a lot of talk lately about regime change in Iraq, but with all the discussion about war in the Persian Gulf, not a lot has been said about the administration's more long-term plans. We spoke with Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and posed the question, if not Saddam Hussein, then who?
There's been some speculation about who might follow. In fact, there have been some quite clear statements that military rule by the United States will be the first event after the defeat of Saddam Hussein.
Yes, U.S. General U.S. General Tommy Franks.
Yes, Tommy Franks will become MacArthur, and Iraq will become Japan. And if we solved everything in Japan, it seems like we'll be able to solve everything in Iraq. So that's one scenario. Of course, this is already being talked about as a temporary or transitional mode, that something has to follow this. Here we get into some complications. The first complication is the belief that somehow we can resurrect the Hashemite monarchy in Iraq to bring back maybe Abdullah II, from Jordan to Iraq, or to bring back one of the lesser nobility who now reside in London, who had been overthrown in 1958. You have to remember that when the Afghan war was going on, we fantasized briefly about bringing old Zahir Shah from his suburb in Rome to rule in Kabul. And then, of course, we scuttled that at the Loya Jirga. So there's talk about bringing back kings. And, you know, I have to say that there's an element of, one would have to call it racism, in the belief that, people in the darker nations can only be ruled by authoritarian rulers. So there's something unpalatable about the monarchical explanation.
As opposed to having some version of democracy.
Right. And there's a sense, I think, both in state and at the Pentagon, that these people are not capable of democracy. And I find that extraordinary. So that's the first, scenario, as it were. The second scenario is that one of these groups of exiles will take over. Now, here we go into two directions. One is that we have a military government of the Iraqis following the U.S. transitional military government. There are scores of exiled, lower rank Iraqi officers who live in Scandinavia, in Britain, and in the United States, in Texas, as a matter of fact. And the first group, therefore, of Iraqis that might rule would be a military dictatorship of one kind or the other. Now, this is also ahistorical. When Iraq, the only really dictatorship, military rule in Iraq was from 1958, and that under Abdel Qasim was not seen by the people as a military dictatorship. In fact, when Qasim overthrew the monarchy, people rose in the streets to celebrate both the demise of the monarchy and to call upon Qasim and the free officers to open up Iraq into some kind of democratic form of governance.
Well, now, what about the opposition groups that we know are operating in? Well, I don't know how fully they're operating, but there are opposition groups in Iraq. What kind of position might they have in this? How would they factor into a post-attack scenario?
Right. Well, this is the complication. If we leave the military behind and if we leave the monarchy behind, then we enter civilian government. And here there's a serious complication for the United States. Our principal ally, who we had at some point thought might be, something like the Northern Alliance, is the Iraqi National Congress, led by Ahmad Chalabi, who has no credibility within Iraq, it seems. He tried to cobble together a coalition between 1992 and 1996, principally of the Kurdish factions and some Shia factions from the south. But by all indications, Chalabi is not considered seriously within Iraq. So our main ally, the Iraqi National Congress, is mainly exists because of congressional funding. And it's not a credible force. Now, coming to people like the Kurds, one has to understand that for the Kurds, the last 10 years, ironically, have perhaps been the best years of Kurdish history in the modern period. Because the Kurds in the last 10 years have carved out this awkward autonomous region from the Iraqi state, protected to some extent by United States Air Force. And they've created, something like a republic, so much so that the two principal Kurdish factions have been fighting with each other less now than they did earlier.
So is it possible they wouldn't necessarily want to be a part of any civilian government taking over in Iraq?
I think they are terrified. They're terrified because, on the one hand, they don't want to see Saddam Hussein re-exert power in the north. Secondly, if the United States prevails, they know that the U.S. government's closeness to Turkey will mean an autonomous or even an independent Kurdistan will be impossible. So they don't look forward to that with any great glee. Mm-hmm. Therefore, to some extent, the status quo suits the Kurds. And, you know, one has to realize that if there is going to be domestic military opposition, the Kurds are the most credible force, even though, you know, they're nothing compared to the Iraqi army, which itself is nothing compared to the United States army. So the Kurds are not going to be, the two main Kurdish factions have not expressed that much enthusiasm for this war. You know, they came to Washington, they signed an accord with each other, but everything was essentially quite lukewarm. There's not been the enthusiasm of, say, Ahmad Shah Massoud coming to Paris and pleading with the Europeans to help him overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan. There's really no parallel at all.
So even though Saddam Hussein attacked the Kurds in the north during the first Gulf War, which was what precipitated the first Gulf War, they are still not anxious to have any kind of regime change in Iraq now.
Well, we have to keep remembering that in 1988, when Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi army took action against the Kurds, they did so with full knowledge of the United States. So not only do Kurdish groups have a sense of distrust of Saddam, and in fact hatred of Saddam, they also distrust the United States. The same policy will then apply, or same principle will apply in the South, where the various Shia groups have some leverage. You know, many of the Shia groups are based in Tehran. They fled there, not just because they had come under action from Saddam Hussein, but also because they had been left behind after the Gulf War. They'd been asked to rise, as is now, you know, very well known. They got no U.S. support. It was essentially like the Bay of Pigs, and they fled to Tehran.
Mm.
Now, for those groups, you know, which are very much Khomeiniite, you know, they follow forms of political ideology very similar to the Iranian revolution currents. Those groups are not that keen to join up with the United States because, after all, the next axis of evil country is Iran.
Iran, Syria.
I mean, in a sense, we are entering here into a situation where there seems to be an unlikely outcome for those who are interested in democracy. After the war, if there is to be a war, what I think is going to happen is we are going to have an endless military occupation. Either the United States Army will formally rule, or the United States Army will rule with perhaps an Iraqi puppet dictatorship, whether military or civilian.
And so what about the Ba'ath Party, the remains of the Ba'ath Party in the aftermath of an attack against Iraq? Does regime change just automatically mean that the Ba'ath Party, along with Saddam Hussein, is sort of down the drain?
Well, here's what I find so interesting, and I'm glad you raised the question of the Ba'ath Party. You know, the more you demonize one person, the more illusions are spread among people when we now begin to believe that if Saddam Hussein disappears, everything will be fine. You know, we fail to understand that Saddam Hussein is a member of a party which is a semi-fascist organization with extensive networks around the Iraqi cities and countryside. It's not just a one-man rule. You know, people may throw the example, say, of Romania, and say Ceausescu was overthrown and then finally democracy, you know, emerged. When is the last time anybody has been to Romania and seen the effects or the lingering effects of the Ceausescu rule? So what I'm trying to get at is that the Ba'ath Party will not be destroyed overnight. The Ba'ath Party, you know, is a strong organization. They are, of course, no match, again, militarily for the United States, but the organization on the ground is fairly strong.
Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Hans Blix, the current head of the UN weapons inspection team in Iraq, said today that he's unable to guarantee that the newly formed team will be free of American spies, as was the case in 1999. Speaking with Peace Watch last week, Iraq's ambassador to the UN, Mohammed Al-Duri, said he wasn't concerned about the composition of the inspection team. According to Al-Duri, the more pressing issue will likely be the U.S.-UK imposed no-fly zones, which Iraq declares as a threat to its national sovereignty.
It is not a decision by the Security Council. It is a unilateral decision by American government and the British government. And this is our sovereignty. Nobody can impede us to do that. So we will continue to fight those who come.
But doesn't the resolution require that there be no response that
Absolutely.
Could be considered
there is no
hostile?
Resolution. There is a resolution.
That's not, part of the resolution?
No, not at all. It is not accepted by even by the Secretary General or by other members, the 13 other members of Security Council. We didn't interpret any resolution giving the permission to American and to British to impose, first of all, this no-fly zone or to impose any restriction to Iraqi people to defend their sovereignty. So this is a pure American and a British decision. It's not a UN decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it possible that the U.S. and Britain can interpret that as a breach, a material breach, of Resolution 1441?
No, nobody can consider that as a material breach. And if they would attack Iraq, certainly today they can attack Iraq because they are stronger and they can wage war anytime, you know. Iraq, a very small country, very small people. We have no conventional weapons, no other weapons, no other possibilities. So if we had been attacked, certainly we can address the international community that this kind of aggression has to be stopped by the Security Council. Otherwise, with our force, we cannot. You know, during 12 years, they are attacking us on a daily basis, and we have no possibility to stop them.
Ambassador, many in the mainstream media have said Iraq says yes to the inspectors coming back into Baghdad, but what does yes mean? In other words, they are suspicious that Iraq will not be cooperative with the inspectors. What's your reaction to that?
You know, we have already repeatedly said that we accept the return of inspectors without any conditions, without any problem. You know, we need that because the Iraqi people suffered a lot during these 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we need really to finish with this headache and huge sacrifice. We lost a lot of people, more than 1,700,000 people. So really, we repeated this several times that we would like to see the end of the sanctions, and we would like to follow all roads, canals, streets to reach that goal. And one of the important one is to declare Iraq clean from any kind of mass destruction weapons. But here in the United States, they don't want to believe us. So we extended invitation to the Congress, even to Britain, who are accusing us, to come to Iraq and to see that Iraq is clean from any kind of mass destruction weapons. Iraq is a peaceful country. In spite of all this machine of propaganda dressed against it, we have no problems to have a very normal relationship with American people. We are not against the American people. We are not threatening the vital interest of American people or any kind of interest. We are a big country of oil. We have a lot of reserve of oil. And we would like to have a normal relationship so we can sell our oil and whatever we can to the United States. And also we need United States, their technology and also their science and also their economy. So we would like one day to have our relationship with American people normalized. So really my message to through you to the American people, please try to stop American administration to wage war against my country. The war means destruction. The war means more killings. The war, we have lost a lot of people. We are facing, and we facing now, a huge problems mm-hmm. of health, of sewage water, of schools, of economy. So we don't need this war. And really, if you are afraid from something, we can assure you that we have no mass destruction weapons at all.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown.